Ecclesiastes chapter 2, and this morning we're going to be looking at verses 18 to 23. I think a lot of you know that my sister and her family have recently moved here from Puerto Rico. And one of the things that Kathy had to do before being able to move was to clear out my parents' house. Actually, she and her family had been living there, I think, since January, and it took her 6 months or so, little by little, to go through my parents' possessions, to make decisions about what to do with them, to liquidate their assets, and to move on to this new stage of life. And she found a lot of mementos from their life, my parents' life of 50 years together and serving the Lord. And she distributed those things among the children. It's been really neat to look through some of my dad's papers and books and so forth. And I brought a few of these things today. This is a Greek parsing sheet from I don't know when, back in the late 50s and early 60s, when my dad was studying Greek, I guess, in graduate school. And this looks like the very same form I used when I was in school as well, identifying the parts of speech and parsing these verbs. So I have some of those. I've got a notebook here that is from when my dad took Old Testament Introduction from Mr. Raymond, who is Robert Raymond, who went on to write a very well-known systematic theology. And it's fascinating because I teach this course now, and a lot of the factual information, thankfully, is the same after 50, 60 years regarding different texts of the Old Testament and themes of books. And it's really a very special thing since I teach this particular class to be able to look back on his notes. I teach another class called Old Testament Theology, and here is a paper, I think, dated to 1962, as he was toward the end of his seminary degree, the Noachian period of revelation, impartial fulfillment of the requirements for the course Old Testament Theology, a nice 15, 16, 17-page paper about that period. And we treasure these kinds of memories from periods of people's lives, people that we love, people that we're connected with. And yet, when somebody gets to that stage of life, it's also a very sad thing because you see their life just kind of dwindling away, and particularly their possessions dwindling away. When my sister was wrapping up that whole process, it hit me after she had mailed all this stuff around and he had gotten, of course, he had gotten settled into our house and we were just kind of sorting through all these things, that at a certain point, it hit me, really most of my dad's material possessions are now in this little room that he lives in our house. There's a kind of a disappointment and a kind of a sadness that hits you when you see somebody's life materially just kind of dwindling down. And I bring that up because that is precisely the feeling, that is precisely the tone of the passage that we're looking at this morning. If you remember, starting at chapter 1, verse 12 here in Ecclesiastes, Solomon has been recounting various areas of earthly life that he had carefully tested. He had conducted this intense experiment as he was on this quest for ultimate profit in life. And he has concluded, he has told us that wisdom in its various forms did not satisfy his quest for that which is substantial, something that matched up to his heart. He has told us as well that pleasure in its various forms left him dissatisfied as well. And what we're looking at today in verses 18 to 23 is the final test that he is recounting in this section of the book. And he is expanding on one of the avenues of pleasure that he had actually discussed already, but revisiting it and dealing with it more specifically, and that is the area of material wealth. We're going to see here that he refers to it with the word toil. And toil, of course, has to do with his work. It has to do with the exertion that he puts forth in order to carry out his work. He is speaking of the back-breaking nature of work in a cursed world. And yet sometimes the word toil, though it's alluding to that, is actually talking about the result of the work. That is, what have you gained materially? What have you gotten out of it? And he's talking about all of the wealth that he accumulated by means of his toil. In fact, look with me as he starts in verse 18. And he says, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. So he says, I hated my toil in which I toiled, seeing I must leave it. The it refers back to the original toil. What's he talking about? He's not talking about leaving his work so much. He's talking about leaving his wealth that he toiled so much for. And as we read this passage, it'll become very apparent that that's what he's discussing here. Material wealth that one accumulates through a life of work, and how that fits into this whole quest for profit, for satisfaction. Well, it's not a surprise at this point, after everything that's been said in the last chapter and a half, that as he evaluates wealth, he is going to come to the conclusion, this also is vanity. In fact, he mentions that three times here. It's in verse 19, it's in verse 21, and it's in verse 23 that all of this wealth that his toil brought him is vain. It is vapory. It is without transcendent substance. That's what he's getting at here. And so our message today is making this point that wealth does not satisfy. Wealth does not satisfy. And Solomon is so dogmatic about that point that for the second time, he uses the strong word hate. You remember that that was the note that we ended on in our passage last week. If you look at verse 17, he says, in a general sense, I hated life. And I pointed out that even for Christians, there is an appropriate way to say that. You and I, if we're thinking as Solomon is thinking and using the term the way he's using it, we ought to go around hating life, meaning we find it entirely unsatisfying as far as our hearts are concerned, and we reject it as the focus of our lives. We reject it because we find it to be so empty in terms of our inner man and in terms of what is ultimate is concerned. Solomon made that strong statement about life in general. And now more specifically, he goes on and says, verse 18, I hate my toil, meaning I hate the wealth that my toil has produced. That is just how dissatisfied he was. He actually ended up hating his wealth. And as he develops that point, he's going to give us three reasons that wealth leaves you in that position, three reasons that wealth does not satisfy. The first of these he doesn't say much about. He mentions it in passing almost in verse 18. I think probably he doesn't develop it because it's so obvious, and yet it is the foundation of everything else he's going to say, and it's something that we do well to stop and consider because it's a truth that we want to avoid most of the time. What is the first reason that material wealth does not satisfy? It is because, verse 18, part A, wealth does not satisfy because you cannot take it with you when you die. Wealth does not satisfy because you cannot take it with you when you die. And that is a truth clearly in view. When Solomon starts out in verse 18, he says, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun. And this is now the part that we're getting this thought from, 18b. Seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. He is conscious that he is not going to be able to take all this stuff with him into the next life. He's got to leave it to somebody. Somebody else is going to end up with that stuff as far as his own enjoyment of it. For as immortal and eternal as he might be, all that stuff that he worked his life to obtain, he is not going to be able to take with him. I ran across a couple Jewish proverbs along these lines. One says this: a child comes into the world with clenched fists, ready to grab for everything, but a corpse leaves with open palms, unable to take anything with him. Or another one that says, there are no pockets in a shroud. Now, we say that one doesn't quite work in our culture because we do bury people with clothes, and sometimes the clothes might have pockets. So we have other ways in our culture of making this point. Maybe you've heard this saying that you never see a hearse pulling a U-Haul. To make this point, I think we do well to consider real-life illustrations of this reality. And one that I think about with this passage is from the man who actually coined the saying, he who dies with the most toys wins. You ever heard that or wonder where that came from? He who dies with the most toys wins. Let me read to you what Wikipedia says to describe this man's wealth. He, quote, had a lavish lifestyle, exemplified by his private capitalist tool, Boeing 727 Trijet, ever larger Highlander yachts, huge art collection, substantial collection of Harley-Davidson motorbikes, French chateau, collections of special shape hot air balloons and historical documents, as well as his opulent birthday parties. He chose the Palais Mendouve, which he had acquired from the Moroccan government in 1930. He chose that palace in the northwest city of Tangier, Morocco, to host his 70th birthday party, spending an estimated $2.5 million. How much did you spend on your last birthday party or your children's last party? $2.5 million. He chartered a Boeing 747, a DC-8, and a Concorde to fly in 800 of the world's rich and famous from New York and London. The guests included his friend Elizabeth Taylor, who acted as co-host, Barbara Walters, Henry Kissinger, half a dozen U.S. state governors, and the CEOs of scores of multinational corporations likely to advertise in his magazine. The party entertainment was on a grand scale, including 600 drummers, acrobats, and dancers, and a fantasia, that is a cavalry charge which ends with the firing of muskets into the air by 300 Berber horsemen. And we're talking here about billionaire Malcolm Forbes, who for decades was the publisher of Forbes magazine. He died of a heart attack in 1990, and by that point he had collected many of his toys in a series of galleries in New York City. And you could go there and see a collection of Olympic medals from famous athletes, a famous gathering of Fabergé eggs, an armada of 500 ships and 12,000 toy soldiers. I mean, literally, he who dies with the most toys wins. These were 12,000 toy soldiers. And, also along the lines of toys, one of the original Monopoly boards. Eventually, Forbes' family sold off most of those items. And by 2014, the galleries were closed. He went on, his stuff stayed. If his life proves anything, it is that he who dies with the most toys dies. That's what Solomon is trying to stress for us here, lest we have the wrong viewpoint of material possessions. And Solomon was not the last one to say it. Jesus said this: take care and be on guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. And do you know what was the context when that saying came up? He actually said that in response to somebody who had a dispute with his brother about an inheritance. And he came to Jesus wanting for Jesus to arbitrate so that he would get a good chunk of the inheritance. And Jesus said, I'm not getting into that. And your focus is all wrong anyway. He says, beware of covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. And then what does Jesus do? He goes on to tell a parable of a man whose wealth kept growing and growing, and he had these big plans, these ambitious plans to keep edifying bigger and bigger barns to collect his goods. And what did God say to that man? He said, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? That's what Solomon is saying. Jesus concluded the parable by saying in Luke 12:21, so is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. There's another kind of wealth that really is answering to the quest that Solomon was after. But as far as people who live their lives seeking that satisfaction in the things of this world, Jesus says, you're going to be just like this man. Your life is going to be snuffed out. And then whose things will these be? They won't be yours anymore. And Paul said about everybody, 1 Timothy 6:7, we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. And so this theme keeps building and keeps getting applied throughout the scriptures. Wealth does not satisfy because you cannot take it with you when you die. Number two, and really getting to the main point that Solomon has in this passage, in verses 19 to 21, wealth does not satisfy because its future is insecure. Wealth does not satisfy because its future is insecure. And Solomon's really worked up here, not about the fact that he can't take it with him. He accepts that. That's a reality nobody can escape. He is worked up about, here I've poured my whole life into building this empire. I can't take it with me, but I would hope that at least it would remain on earth and that my descendants would be able to keep that and to manage it wisely and to continue to enjoy it, and for this to have some kind of long-term benefit for people. And he realizes there is no guarantee of that. In fact, the likelihood is that over time, this is going to be squandered. Wealth does not satisfy because its future is insecure. The fact that he is so concerned about that really shows how sober-minded and kind of selfless he is being in asking these questions. He's thinking about the future. He's thinking about his descendants. He's looking for something that's going to last, that they're going to be able to enjoy indefinitely. And that's not inherently a bad concern. In fact, Solomon wrote this in Proverbs 13:22, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. It is a noble thing to try to accumulate some measure of wealth, not just for yourself, but for generations to come and to pass it on to them. And yet, what's going to happen with it after that is totally out of your hands. And there is no guarantee that they're going to manage that inheritance well. We might worry about that. We might occasionally think about, you know, generations upon generations, what's going to happen with my wealth. But I would imagine that a lot of us eventually just kind of shrug our shoulders and we say, well, as long as I have enough and as long as I'm happy with what I have, then you know, let whatever happen in the future. Solomon is really thinking on a higher plane. He is thinking about his descendants. He wants there to be something lasting. And yet, when he does that, it only ends up exacerbating his frustration. And he deals with this future in two waves. Look first of all at verse 19. So he's got to leave it, verse 18, to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will be the master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. And at that point, he is uncertain about how his inheritance is going to be handled. He says, part of the frustration is you just don't know. There are no guarantees. There is an uncertainty about it. And that lack of security deeply troubles me, because I would have thought that after using all my wisdom and being so successful, I would be able to make sure that something would be permanent. And he says that there are no assurances in life like that. And in this first wave, in verse 19, he is uncertain about how it's going to be handled. Who knows whether he will be a wise or fool? Actually, it gets more frustrating as he goes on to the second wave, developing the same thought in verses 20 and 21. It is more pessimistic. And he gets at there the very real possibility that, in fact, his successor is going to be a fool. At that point, it's not like, who knows whether he's going to be wise or fool. You read this, and it's like, you know, probably he's going to be a fool. If statistics hold, probably that's what's going to happen. Read here verses 20 and 21. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and great evil. Let's think about those verses for a moment. First of all, he says, so I turned about. And you might remember last time I brought up the English word turn. This is a little bit different word than what was used before, but it is related. In verse 11, he said, I turned on all that my hands had done. And then in verse 20, he says, I turned to consider wisdom. So he had been looking at one thing. He had turned to that, and then now to another thing, and now he says, I turned around. And you read this in that light, and it's almost like you're getting whiplash from all this turning. I mean, I sense this man as starting to kind of freak out, just like, again, when you lose something, you start turning around everywhere like crazy, trying to find it. And at this point, he actually says, I turned and gave my heart up to despair. And again, he had spoken before about the heart. In chapter 1, verse 13, he had applied his heart to wise analysis of life. In chapter 2, verse 1, he had said in his heart, I will test you. So before, it's kind of like he's objectively examining in a kind of a detached way. Like he's looking at all these things and he's got full reign over his heart as he checks that out and examines that over there and tests that over there and comes to these conclusions. And at this point, it's like, this is just hopeless. And he's moving away from this kind of detached sort of scientific experiment, just says, I gave my heart over to despair. That this is a totally hopeless endeavor. Now, once again, I'm going to suggest that every one of us needs to give our heart up to despair. That is actually a good thing. Not in every respect, but in terms of what he's talking about. He was looking for substance and satisfaction in the things of earth. He came to the conclusion that is a hopeless endeavor. And as far as this original test is concerned, I despair. There is nothing out there. I'm going to give my heart over to despair over that issue. And I believe he's doing that as an example for us. That you and I, if we are evaluating material things, we ought to be hopeless that the answer to our heart's longings is found there. In fact, the Apostle Paul told Timothy to tell wealthy people, 1 Timothy 1:17, not to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches. That is exactly what Solomon is saying here. You ought to be hopeless as far as material wealth is concerned, because that is not where it's at. Don't set your hopes on that. Despair of riches in that regard. You and I ought to feel hopeless when it comes to wealth, when we think about how it can be squandered so easily and so quickly by later generations. We shouldn't be feeling good and secure about material things. It is a very unstable object of hope. And verse 21 gives us some more on that. One reason for not setting your hopes on riches is because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. And let's look at some of the wording there. When he says sometimes a person, literally that says there is or even there was a person about whom this was true. And it may be that Solomon is referring to some specific individual that he had observed that this happened to. Somebody very wise like himself, somebody devoted their lives to managing, stewarding well, successfully, wisely, with skill, their possessions. And yet they turn it over to somebody who's not on that plane at all, and somebody who had not worked for those things. When he says sometimes there is or there was a person, and it refers to their wealth, the word in our version is he must leave everything to be enjoyed. Literally that says he must leave his portion to this other individual, which is sad because that term portion we've encountered already. It's going to be a big theme going forward. Solomon is going to use the word portion for an individual's divinely allotted piece of life that God gives you that includes all the circumstances. And included in that would be all the pleasures that he has kind of cut out of life for you to enjoy. And here's this guy who's got his own portion. And it comes from God during his life. But after he's gone, it's passed on to somebody else. The thing allotted for him is now totally out of his hands and is put at the disposal of somebody else. What was so special to the father is just going poof over time. And you really have to wonder, if Solomon actually had these kinds of questions and these doubts about his own son, Rehoboam? We understand what happened with Rehoboam was after Solomon was gone. But it sounds like he is afraid that this was going to happen to him. You wonder what his concerns were about Rehoboam. Well, we read in 2 Kings that Rehoboam rejected the wise counsel, right? We're talking about was the wise counsel of the older generation. And instead of lightening up some of the oppression of his father, he says, I'm going to make it even worse and abuse you even more. You better get in line here. And what happens? You talk about his father's toil dissipating quickly. 10 of the 12 tribes say, we're out of here. We are not even going to be under your authority or a part of your kingdom anymore. We're starting our own kingdom. We've had it with you. And the time came when the judgment of God for the sins of Solomon as well as for the folly of Rehoboam came to this. It says in 2 Kings 14, 25 to 28, in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. He took away the treasures of the house of Yahweh and the treasures of the king's house. He took away everything. He also took away all the shields of gold that Solomon had made. And King Rehoboam made in their place shields of bronze and committed them to the hands of the officers of the guard who kept the door of the king's house And as often as the king went into the house of Yahweh, the guard carried them and brought them back to the guard room. It's really a kind of a pathetic picture here. You got this opulent palace, and the gold is stripped off and taken by Shishak, and here Rehoboam is trying to recover some little part of the glory of the kingdom, and so he makes these shields of bronze because that's what was left. It's like they're not even sure whether this is going to survive, and they have to have this special place over here and these soldiers to guard, make sure nothing happens to our little shields of bronze. It's really kind of a pathetic picture of how the kingdom had degenerated. Why does this happen? Well, Solomon suggests one of the reasons that this kind of thing happens in life when he says that all of this wealth is given over to someone who did not toil for it. And here's a real tension when it comes to thinking about the future and thinking about leaving an inheritance for our children. It's a good thing to leave your children an inheritance. And it's a good thing to want your children to have a quote-unquote better life than you had. But if you think back on your life and what made you who you are and what developed in you character and trust in God and love for God, whatever degree of sanctification you've enjoyed, isn't it true that most of that is the product not of having a good and cushy life? Most of our growth comes from adversity. Most of our growth comes from need, including material needs. Some of the greatest lessons I've learned and the things that I look back on as evidences of God's work in my life have to do with I was broke. And I prayed, and in unexpected ways, apart from me working, God provided. And so here we are, we're wanting to give our children a better life so they don't have to have it as hard as we do. And Solomon is suggesting there's a place for that, but at the same time realize that that puts your children in a weakened position. They are not going to have the kinds of opportunities of need that you had to learn about God and to grow in faith like you did. And you may actually be cursing them by leaving them too much because they did not toil for that. And the likelihood is that that is going to engender a kind of a spoiled, self-centered, soft, materialistic attitude, and in their foolishness, they may very well squander the very thing that you wanted to leave for them. The very gifts we leave them can end up being a snare to them precisely because they did not have to work for them. Material wealth does not satisfy because its future is insecure. And with that thought in mind, Solomon is concluding this section by sort of doubling what he had said before. Not only this is vanity, but this is vanity and a great evil. This is awful. That after all, I mean, can you just think about it? Think about stories you've heard or maybe things your family went through back in the years of the Depression, and just overnight, everything's gone. That's the sense here. This is vanity and this is a great evil. And you are wasting your life to think that you're something or you've arrived at something or you're going to have true joy when this is what can happen and often does happen to material wealth. But he is not done even yet, as he has a couple verses left on this topic, and he teaches us this third and final truth, that wealth does not satisfy because it is accompanied by crushing pressures. Wealth does not satisfy because it is accompanied by crushing pressures. Listen to verse 22. It's a question. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? That's really just another way of saying the original question that started off this whole book of chapter 1, verse 3. What profit is there in life? Here's the point. He has gone two chapters considering that question, and now he's wrapping up this section after all those tests he's conducted, and he still has the same question. He hasn't found an answer to the question. He's still asking the same basic thing. What profit is there? What does a man have of any substantial, eternal, permanent value? He went through all these things, and it only left him with the same question. And as if he hasn't proven this already, he adds another argument for us in verse 23. And what this verse is doing is teasing out the idea of toil, emphasizing the burdensomeness of the work that is required in order to obtain and in order to maintain wealth. Listen to verse 23. For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. Let's probe those words here as we close. All his days are full of sorrows. Literally, that says all his days are sorrows. There's not really any word full of there. All his days are sorrows. In other words, he is equating days with sorrows. Or you could think of it this way: one more day, one more sorrow. That is the nature of life. One more day, one more pain in the neck. One more day, one more burden. Every day characterized by grief and sorrow and trouble. And then he uses the word vexation, which he had used for wisdom back in chapter 1, verse 18, and now he's using it for work. And you may remember that that also is a strong word. It's a word that typically is used of God in his anger judging the people of Israel. God is so worked up emotionally that he is angry toward them. In this case, as it relates to human reactions to things, it's a term that speaks of something deeply irritating, something wearisome, a burden that bothers you and that won't go away. I mean, isn't that how you feel at the end of most work days? You feel vexed. You're irritated by having to carry this burden and go through these sorrows. But it doesn't stop at the end of the workday. What did the last part of the verse say? Even in the night, his heart does not rest. You don't have to be on the clock to feel vexed. You don't have to be in the workplace to be irritated about toil and everything that goes along with it. Even in the night, your heart does not rest. How many sleepless hours have you spent at the end of a day just kind of rehashing what went on that day? Rehearsing your work for various reasons, but maybe to make sure that you did everything you were supposed to do. Sort of checking it off the list and making sure all the bases were covered. Or how many sleepless hours have you spent planning what you're supposed to do the next day? And it never ends. I mean, you're just like a hamster in one of those wheels, just going round and round. And at night, even though you're not working, you're stressing over what is going on the next day. Or maybe wondering if you're going to be able to pay the bills that month. Or maybe you're stressing about something more long-term because there has been some downturn in the markets and you're wondering whether your retirement money is going to survive. Or you're burdened about trouble your children are going through and whether they're going to be able to make ends meet. The number and the variety of burdens associated with work and wealth, that's what Solomon is referencing here. Even he stayed up late at night. Can you imagine this? Somebody you would think could relax at the end of the day, because everything was taken care of. Even he stayed up late at night worrying about those kinds of things. Now, some of that is normal, and it is acceptable to have a legitimate, appropriate concern and a sense of responsibility. You want to do a good job. You want to fulfill your obligations. You want to provide for your family. Some of that is normal, but often it does become sinful worry. And Solomon could here sort of take that direction and start really going after us about worrying too much. But that's not what he does. What the Lord is telling us through Solomon here is not that worry is wrong. We got other passages in the Bible that deal with that. What he's saying is the fact that earthly life and work and money and possessions, the fact that those things lead us to struggle internally so much, even to the point of worry, the fact that we struggle with worry over those things means that there is something deeply wrong with those things. If you're always worrying about them because they're so uncertain, you're not sure what's going to happen, you're weighed down with obligations and questions, there's something wrong with that. It's not the stable, heart-satisfying, peaceful thing that you're looking for. There's something wrong with that just by the very fact that it tends to lead you to be concerned about it so much. It means that earthly life and all its wealth are vapory, that they are not the ultimate thing God has for his creatures. And so you and I are fools if we think that wealth is going to bring us ultimate joy. Now, going to have to put you off one more week as far as the positive applications of all of these things. We're going to get into verses 24 to 26 next week, Lord willing. But at this point, we're still dwelling on the negative because Solomon is dwelling on the negative. And you wonder why he spends so long this is a painful passage to read. If you really stop and meditate, this is a painful passage to have to read and to have to preach from. You wonder, why did he say so much about it? Well, I imagine that it's because we have such a strong bent to make too much of earthly things. We have such a strong bent to give our lives over to the pursuit of material wealth. And so, here's what a passage like this does for us. Here is the application. A passage like this, it warns us about the folly of materialism. It warns us about the dangers of what we call the American dream. It moves us to repent of the idolatry of covetousness that drives us to workaholism. We need to let the weight of those kinds of applications really settle on our consciences because you and I are so prone, and I'm speaking to myself as well as to you, we are so prone to overvalue work and the wealth that work brings us. And Solomon is saying there's a place for that, but recognize this has too much trouble associated with it for it really to be as great as you think it is. Now, if that is the problem that a passage like this warns us, what is the solution to workaholism, to materialism? What is the solution? And in light of the whole Bible, what could we say that God would use to free us more and more from materialism? Well, I want to revisit very quickly here our 3 points. And what I want to do is to contrast the problems of wealth with what Christ is and does. All right, Jesus is the one to whom this book is ultimately pointing. So how does Jesus fit into those 3 truths about wealth? Well, first of all, we said that wealth does not satisfy you because you cannot take it with you when you die. How does Christ relate to that problem? Well, Christ does satisfy because he is the resurrection and the life. And because through his own substitutionary death, he frees us from the grip of death. You see, he does for us what money cannot. We can't take it with us. We can take him with us, and through him we can ultimately escape death. Number two, wealth does not satisfy because its future is insecure. Answering to that, Christ does satisfy because he has secured for us an eternity of bliss in a creation restored to its original glories. And you know what? The Bible describes that in terms of inheritance. Your descendants might well squander your inheritance, but here is an inheritance that the Bible in 1 Peter calls imperishable, unfading, undefiled. Nobody can damage that one. Your wealth is secure if your wealth is Christ. And number three, we said that wealth does not satisfy because it is accompanied by crushing pressures. How does Christ answer to that? Christ does satisfy, I think, for at least two reasons. Number one, because his grace enables us to endure these pressures. And maybe you know what it is, I hope you do, in those moments of frustration and burden and worry, of approaching Christ and experiencing a renewed peace from him that drives the anxiety away. Christ satisfied because he enables us to endure these pressures, and also because he promises to take them away entirely in the future. Can you imagine a life where worry is not even a temptation? Because there's nothing to worry about. Because you've been freed from the oppression of this cursed world, and nothing's going to go wrong the next day. And you're not going to run out of stuff to eat. You're not going to not be able to pay your bills. Christ secures the inheritance, and therefore he relieves you of the pressure. Listen to this statement from Revelation 22:3. No longer will there be anything accursed. And in keeping with our passage, I would say that includes the curse that sin has brought upon work and material possessions. No longer will there be anything accursed, and the curse associated with work and wealth is one of the things that will go away. One preacher said this: the fellow that has no money is poor. The fellow that has nothing but money is poorer still.